we've been on our Summer of Faith tour. We started about, I think it's 6 weeks ago now, maybe seven, losing track of time. Not a bad thing. I still know where I am. That's a good thing. So we've been looking at, we looked at Noah, we looked at Abraham, we looked at Moses. I'm going to take a different path today, because we're going to look at Solomon and Hezekiah. Now, keeping in mind, they're not listed in Hebrews 11, are they? And keeping in mind, it's not always about looking at those who are pillars of faith, but those who are part of the faith, but may have something that we can learn from. So I continue to share this perspective with you when talking about trust or faith on Shabbat. This is my opening statement. Our faith is revealed through the framework of culture. We do not truly know what we can endure unless it is tested. It is tested by the time and the culture we reside in. Faith is not required in a vacuum, absent of trials and tribulations. Faith flourishes when tested. You don't know what your true capacity of your faith is until it is tested, not just tested, but tested to its limits. Once you reach the limit, you can either go back or you can press forward. There is this perception when investing in stocks. The perception is buy low, sell high. However, there's a reason why the stock is low. When you buy high, you anticipate it going higher. Well, this is the high range of the stock. Keeping in mind, let me give you an example. Apple Computers. Everybody know who Apple is, right? 1997, they were at their low. I don't remember what the price of the stock is. I believe it was $2 or $3 a share, maybe even less than that. 23 years later, they are approaching a value for the company of $2 trillion. If you resisted and saying, well, the stock's at an all-time high, you would have missed out on all the potential afterwards. So I use this analogy that our faith can reach new highs, record highs, trillion-dollar highs, to the point that we shouldn't be limited by where we've already gotten to. God's given us the ability to live beyond the potential that we have set ourselves for. So each Shabbat, since we started our tour, I have reiterated our foundational verse with definitions for the key words of this verse. The verse is Hebrews 11:1. Trusting or faith is being confident of what is hoped for, convinced about things we do not see. Now, keeping in mind, I'm taking a bit of a different approach with regards to Solomon and Hezekiah today. But I want to keep this in the forefront of your minds. To be confident, that is translated as substance in King James, is defined as a state of feeling of certainty about a truth about something. It's a feeling or belief that one can rely on someone or something and that they are firm in their trust. To be convinced, that is the adjective, not the verb, is typically translated as evidence. So you're completely convinced, you're completely certain about something, the evidence. Firm in one's belief with regard to a particular cause or issue. In other words, hopefully you're not sitting on the fence, because you're not convinced if you're sitting on the fence. Your mind is yet to be made up means you're not convinced about something. So today, as we continue our Summer of Faith tour, I want to look at how important it is to finish the race, to endure till the end. In other words, to finish strong. Not to finish with a whimper. Not to, how do I put this, fall over the finish line because you ran out of gas. And you only finished because you were just right there. I believe it's important to look at not only the positive examples of those who came before us, but also to look at others who would struggle at some point in their lives. Both Abraham and Moses had their challenges, yet were able to overcome their challenges. We read of Moses in the end of his life. In Deuteronomy 34, it says, "So Moses, the servant of Adonai, died there in the land of Moab, as Adonai had said." He's still identified as God's servant. Think of this as his tombstone. Moses, the servant of God. This is how he's remembered. This is how he was identified. It says, "He was buried in the valley across from Beit Peor in the land of Moab. But to this day, no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, with eyes undimmed and vigor undiminished. He didn't fall across the line. He ran through it, and if he could have, he would have kept running. If there was another race to be had, he likely would have done it." Torah gives us an account of Abraham's death as well. This is how long Abraham lived, 175 years. 75 years after the promise was first, after Isaac was born. 100 years since God first spoke to him. And Abraham breathed his last, dying at a ripe old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people. We know they both finished their races and are acknowledged by the writer of Hebrews as two examples, two witnesses of faith. For this is what the writer of Hebrews says, "So then, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us too put aside every impediment, that is, the sin which easily hampers our forward movement, and keep running with endurance in the contest set before us." So they concluded their races. Yet the writer of Hebrews is encouraging us that based on their examples, what's been set before us, we are to do as they did. Yet we can learn from those who did not finish the race strongly. Today we're going to look at two kings who started well but did not finish well. You can lead the most laps of a race, but unless you are leading the last lap, you ultimately did not succeed. Finishing well is emphasized by Yeshua. In Matthew 10:22, he says, "Everyone will hate you because of me, but whoever holds out till the end will be preserved from harm." What does Shaul say? Speaking to Timothy, or writing to Timothy, he says in 2 Timothy 4:6 and 7, "For as for me, I am already being poured out on the altar. Yes, the time for my departure has arrived. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept my faith." He went through a lot. I believe Scripture doesn't fully document everything Shaul went through. So when we read of Solomon, the son of David, and Bathsheba, anointed king of Israel in 1 Kings chapter 1, he will ultimately take possession of the throne from his father David, thus continuing the line of David established by Adonai through the covenant he would make with him. And this covenant is made in 2 Samuel chapter 7, starting in verse 8. And just, I'd like to read it out so you guys have an understanding of the starting point of David and therefore the continuation for Solomon. Therefore, say this to my servant David, that this is what Adonai says. I took you from the sheepyards, from following the sheep, to make you chief over my people, over Israel. I have been with you wherever you went. I have destroyed all your enemies ahead of you. And I am making your reputation great, like the reputation of the greatest people on earth. I will assign a place to my people Israel. I will plant them there so that they can live in their own place without being disturbed anymore. The wicked will no longer oppress them as they did at the beginning, and as they did from the time I ordered judges to be over my people Israel. Instead, I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, Adonai tells you that Adonai will make you a house. When your days come to an end and you sleep with your ancestors, I will establish one of your descendants to succeed you, one of your own flesh and blood, and I will set up his rulership. He will build a house for my name, and I will establish his royal throne forever. I will be a father for him, and he will be a son for me. If he does something wrong, I will punish him with a rod and blows, just as everyone gets punished. Nevertheless, my grace will not leave him, as I took it away from Shaul, that is King Saul, whom I removed from before you. Thus your house and your kingdom will be made secure forever before you. Your throne will be set up forever. So this is what God established with David. And we saw in those verses that he would establish a generation that would come through David, and that would start with Solomon. What aspects of the covenant are included here? David's line would have a kingdom. The covenant included David's whole dynasty. David's son is to be adopted as God's own. The covenant is ultimately unlimited in time and space. Jerusalem is the spiritual center of the world, and the temple was to be a sign of the Davidic covenant. So Solomon, the beneficiary of this covenant, succeeds his father in sitting on the throne of Israel upon his father's death. Prior to his death, David instructed his son as follows in 1 Kings 2:3 and 4. Observe the charge of Adonai your God, to go in his ways and keep his regulations, mitzvot, rulings, and instructions in accordance with what is written in the Torah of Moses, so that you will succeed in all you do and wherever you go. So if you want to succeed, you may want to take the words that David gave to Solomon. Because he says, if you do, Adonai will fulfill what he promised me when he said, if your children pay attention to how they live, conducting themselves before me honestly, with all their heart and being, you will never lack a man on the throne of Israel. Ultimately, Adonai's promise was never to leave Solomon. Then we have this account from 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon loved Adonai, living according to the regulation set forth by David, his father. Nevertheless, he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. One time the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. Because that was the main high place, Solomon offered thousands of burnt offerings on the altar there. At Gibeon, Adonai appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said to him, tell me what I should give you. Solomon said, you showed your servant David, my father, much grace as he lived before you honestly and righteously, having an upright heart with you. You preserved this great grace for him by giving him a son to sit on his throne as is the case today. So now, Adonai, my God, you have made your servant king in the place of David, my father. But I am a mere child. I don't know how to lead. Moreover, your servant is among your people, whom you choose, a great people so numerous that they cannot be counted. Therefore, give your servant an understanding heart, able to administer justice to your people, so that I can discern between good and bad, for who is equal to judging this great people of yours? What Solomon had said in making this request pleased Adonai. God said to him, because you have made this request, instead of asking for long life or riches for yourself or your enemy's death, but rather ask for yourself understanding to discern justice, I am doing what you requested. I am giving you a wise and understanding heart. So there has never been anyone like you, nor will there ever again be anyone like you. I am also giving you what you didn't ask for, riches and honor greater than that of any other king throughout your life. More than that, if you will live according to my ways, obeying my laws and mitzvot, like your father David, I will give you a long life. Solomon awoke and found it had been a dream. But he went to Jerusalem, stood before the ark for the covenant of Adonai, and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings. He also made a feast for all his servants. So here you have the dream that Solomon had. And it seems so lifelike. Conversing with Adonai, he sought his wisdom as opposed to the riches of the world or power or notoriety. Yet by asking for what he did, he received the others for which he did not ask. Solomon's reign was a time of peace and prosperity and power. During his reign, the temple and other structures would be built. Leaders from other nations would come to him. Relationships with the nations of Tyre, Arabia, and Egypt, where he would ultimately go and marry Pharaoh's daughter, would all be part of this blessing. Many years of favor would frame the life of Solomon. Unfortunately, with this vast amount of wealth and favor that was bestowed upon him, so too were the trappings of the world. We see Solomon's attention turn from Adonai with the introduction of women who he would take to be his wives from other nations. 1 Kings 11, starting in verse 1. Solomon loved many foreign women besides the daughter of Pharaoh. There were women from Moab, from Ammon, from Edom, from Zidonia, and the Hittites, nations about which Adonai had said to the people of Israel, you are not to go among them or they among you, because they will turn your hearts away toward their gods. But Solomon was deeply attached to them by his love. He had 700 wives, all princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For when Solomon became old, his wives turned his heart away toward other gods, so that he was not wholehearted with Adonai, as David his father had been. And wholehearted means not worshiping others, not worshiping other gods, but worshiping the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the only God. Okay, verse 5. For Solomon followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidoni, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Thus Solomon did what was evil in Adonai's view, and did not fully follow Adonai, as David his father had done. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill in the front of Jerusalem, and another for Molech, the abomination of Amnon. This is what he did for all his foreign wives, who then offered and sacrificed to their gods. Solomon would ultimately ignore the very wisdom bestowed upon him by Adonai and upon his father's final instruction. He did what was evil from the perspective of Adonai. Now I want to share this with you. This phrase is found 23 times in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, a term that has been specifically applied to the kings of Israel and their relationship of Adonai. They did which was evil from the perspective of Adonai, meaning they did abominations. They did abominable things. We see Solomon being the first where this phrase is referenced. The first domino of a line of kings that would lead to a divided kingdom and thus further perpetuation of such actions. Adonai did not stay silent. In 1 Kings 11:9, it starts off, "So Adonai grew angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from Adonai, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and given him orders concerning this matter, that he should not follow other gods, but he didn't obey Adonai's orders. So Adonai said to Solomon, 'Since this is what has been in your mind, and you haven't kept my covenant and my regulations, which I ordered you to obey, I will tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. However, for David, your father's sake, I won't do it while you are alive, but I will tear it away from your son. Even then, I won't tear away all the kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son, for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen.'" So through his action, through Solomon's action, his unfaithfulness, he brought forth a civil war that would lead to the divided kingdom that remains divided to this day. It will be the one from the line of David and Solomon, Yeshua, who will ultimately reunite the kingdom upon his return. Solomon had it all, including the favor and wisdom of Adonai. He most certainly didn't finish the way he started. I want you to keep this in mind. It's not about how you start, it's about how you finish. And you don't know where your finish line is. You don't know when God is going to say, "Well done, time to come home." Next, I want to briefly look at another king, that of Hezekiah. He was the son of Ahaz, a king who did not do what was right from Adonai's perspective. Remember 23 times? This is one of those 23. So Hezekiah had some challenges before him. He succeeded his father. And needless to say, his father didn't leave him with the kingdom of Judah in the best of condition or the best of shape. Starting in Kings or Second Kings, chapter 18. "It was the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, and Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, when he began his reign. He was 25 years old when he began his reign, and he ruled for 29 years. He reigned in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Avi, the daughter of Zechariah." In verse 3, it says, "He did what was right from Adonai's perspective, following the example of everything David, his ancestor, had done." Interestingly, the phrase, "he had done what was right," remember I told you 23 times for the other one? only 7 times in 1st and 2nd Kings. So we're talking more than a 3-to-1 ratio of bad kings to good kings. So Hezekiah had much to overcome, the first being the reputation of his father when he would come to reign over Judah. His father, having done much that was evil from Adonai's perspective, would be Hezekiah's initial task to undo. In 2 Kings, starting in verse 4 of chapter 18, he removed the high places, smashed the standing stones, cut down the Asherah, and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Well, but that was part of the ark. Because in those days the people of Israel were making offerings to it, calling it Nehushtan. In other words, they were creating an idol out of it. He put his trust in Adonai, the God of Israel. After him, there was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, nor had there been among those before him. For he clung to Adonai and did not leave off following him, but obeyed his mitzvot, which Adonai had given Moses. So Adonai was with him. Wherever he went out to battle, he did well. He rebelled against the king of Asher and refused to be his vassal. He drove the Philistines back to Aza, and laid waste to their territory from the watchtower to the fortified city. Hezekiah would come to be challenged by Asher and would ultimately be reassured by Isaiah that they would overcome. His prayer regarding this matter is recorded for our benefit. Hezekiah took the letter from the messengers. This is 2 Kings chapter 19, starting in verse 14. And he read it. He read the letter. Then Hezekiah went up to the house of Adonai and spread it out before Adonai. Hezekiah prayed as follows in the presence of Adonai. Adonai, the God of Israel, who dwells above the cherubim, you alone are God of all the kingdoms on earth. You made heaven and earth. Turn your ear, Adonai, and hear. Open your eyes, Adonai, and see. Hear the words that the sent to taunt the living God. It is true, Adonai, that the kings of Asher have laid waste the nations and their lands and have thrown their gods into the fire. For those were non-gods, merely the product of people's hands, wood and stone. This is why they come to destroy them. Now, therefore, Adonai, our God, please save us from his power, so that all the kingdoms on earth will know that you are Adonai. And he says, you only. And thus ultimately triumph over their adversary through the power and favor of Adonai would occur. So he had much favor. He was doing everything well. And keeping in mind, what we're going to see here isn't major, but he still didn't finish strong. 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 1. Around this time, Hezekiah became ill to the point of death. Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came and said to him, here is what Adonai says. Put your house in order, because you are going to die, you will not live. This, in essence, is a doctor saying to someone who's terminal, get your affairs in order, because you don't have long. Hezekiah's response to this news was to pray. Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed to Adonai. I pleaded with you, Adonai, remember now how I have lived before you truly and wholeheartedly, and now I have done what you see as good. And he cried bitter tears. And then in verse 5, God says to Isaiah, go back and tell Hezekiah, the prince of my people, that this is what Adonai, the God of David, your ancestor, says. I've heard your prayer and seen your tears, and I will heal you. On the third day, you are to go up to the house of Adonai. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will rescue you and this city from the power of the king of Asher. I will defend the city for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. One would look at this and praise Adonai, the healer who extends Hezekiah life an additional 15 years. However, what did the next 15 years look like? There's not much that's written. But then we see that the envoys from Babel come to Judah, whereby Hezekiah would provide them with an unfettered tour of all his treasures, for which Isaiah would respond as follows in Isaiah 39, starting in verse 5. Hear what Adonai says. The day will come when everything in your palace, along with everything your ancestors stored up until today, will be carried off to Babel. Nothing will be left, says Adonai. They will carry off some of your descendants, your family, your own offspring, and they will be made eunuchs, serving in the palace of the king of Babel. What was Hezekiah's response to the words of Isaiah? The word of Adonai, which you just told me, is good. Because he thought, at least peace and truth will continue during his lifetime. This is good. His words seemed rather prideful, yet also that being indifferent. It doesn't matter. It won't be in my lifetime. It seems as if it was a total disregard for the kingdom he serves, not to mention his family and the future fate, let alone his God. So two kings who had done what was right in the sight of Adonai did not finish as strongly as they started. Our lives as believers in Yeshua do have an impact on those around us. Solomon's actions led to a divided kingdom, while Hezekiah's indifference led to Babel's ability to assess all of Israel, to all that Israel had, in advance of Adonai, enabling them to execute his judgment upon his people. There was no concern for his descendants or for the nation of what would befall them so long as it wasn't in his life. Who knows who would have come after Hezekiah had he not prayed, receiving 15 years of additional life. We most certainly have our struggles along our journey of faith. Don't let the elements of the world distract you from the path that has been revealed to you and the destination that lies at the end of the path for you. That is Adonai's kingdom. Remain confident and convinced of what has been revealed to you both today and tomorrow. Utilize Adonai's reality to further guide you and sustain you as we draw closer to the day of Yeshua's return. Know that for you have been warned, tribulation will only intensify. Thus your faith must equally intensify. I want to close with the words of Kepha, speaking to those who he identifies as shepherds of others, of congregations. He conveys the following. He says, likewise, this is 1 Peter chapter 5, starting in verse 5. Likewise, you who are less experienced, submit to leaders. Further, all of you should clothe yourselves in humility towards one another, because God opposes the arrogant, but to the humble he gives grace. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that at the right time he may lift you up. Throw all your anxieties upon him, because he cares about you. Stay sober. Stay alert. Your enemy, the adversary, stalks about like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Stand against him, firm in your trust, knowing that your brothers throughout the world are going through the same kinds of suffering. You will have to suffer only a little while. After that, God, who is full of grace, the one who called you to his eternal glory in union with Messiah, will himself restore, establish, and strengthen you and make you firm. To him be the power forever and ever. Amen. If this is good for the shepherd, it's likely good for the sheep as well. The encouragement of continuing to seek being restored, being strengthened. What would have transpired if Solomon had finished stronger or Hezekiah had finished stronger? Keeping in mind, everything happens that ultimately leads to God accomplishing his purpose. I don't believe these were surprises, but I believe these were revealed to us as examples on what to do and what not to do, how to live and how not to live, what to pursue and what not to pursue. So I want you to keep all these things in mind, because today is about finishing strong, not running out of gas, not running out of faith, or not having a diminished faith, because there's still much to do. You don't know when your time is done. Therefore, you have to continue. You always have the option to walk away. However, I don't consider that an option. It shouldn't be an option. I've shared examples of people walking away. I did a sermon a couple months ago comparing two people, one who endured till the end, one who walked away for various reasons. The examples are endless. We should not be discouraged, but we should continue to persevere. And again, we're being confronted with things that are, for lack of another word, and I hate using this, not normal. Isolation is not something we were created for. Yet we're starting to see the impact of isolation amongst people. Another pandemic is in the process of occurring, and it's the response of this pandemic we're going through now. This is why we need to even rely more on God. We need to rely more on his Spirit. He says we're not alone, that the Comforter is with us. So even though we may be isolated in our own apartments and homes, technically we're not alone, even though we are. So keep these things in mind, that you still have a race to run. You're not done. Time for your second wind. So if everybody will please rise.